changed.
Yeah, it does help to put the mic on. That helps. Well, it's really great to be here today. Talk about a lot of different things about animal behavior today. And just get started out. You know, you get people that say, well, it's anthropomorphic to say that animals have emotions. Well, researchers figured out a long time ago that animals actually have emotions. And the thing is that most of this research has been hidden over in the neuroscience research. One of the big problems we have in a lot of different things is everybody just reads their own literature. You've got the neuroscientists over here, the veterinarians here, the animal scientists here, the horse people over here, and nobody's reading across other people's literature. And the science that shows that animals have emotion has actually been done a long time ago. So I went and dug it up out of the scientific literature. And what do emotions do? They motivate behavior. You know, what's motivation? Well, you can be motivated to get away from something that's scary. You can be motivated to go investigate something. There's actually an emotional system in the brain for novelty seeking. You know, the new things. New things are both scary and attractive. They are attractive if the animal voluntarily approaches. Scary if you corner it and just ram it in its face. That's sort of the paradox of novelty. You know, new stuff's both scary and attractive. And if you have an animal that's got real high-strung genetics, if you were to put, you know, flag out in the middle of the pasture, that high-strung one will go up to it first. But if you corner it and you jam it in its face, it's going to be the first one that really, really get upset about it. And the thing is, you know, feelings, some people call it feelings, they motivate behavior. So let's look at some hard data that animals have emotions. Well, Prozac works on dogs. Now, if you want to look at some of the research, there's some good databases on the internet that I'd like you to know about. How many people here know how to do the PubMed database? Okay, we need a lot more people to learn that. That is the National Library of Medicine database. You can search all the veterinary literature, all the scientific papers, and all the human health literature too. It's PubMed, P-U-B-M-E-D, PubMed. And that stands for public medicine. You'll see a thing that says PubMed Home. Click on that. Then another search box will come up. That now puts you into the National Library of Medicine. And it will just give you free summaries of journal articles. How many people here know how to do Google Scholar? Okay, that's real super easy to do. Go to Google, type in Google Scholar. It will bring up a link to Google Scholar. That tends to get you into more scientific kind of stuff. Now, you also want to do searches on regular Google, too, because there's a lot of professors' websites that don't pull up on Google Scholar. So you've got to do all the different things. And where the emotions originate in the brains of all mammals is in the subcortex, in the more primitive part of the brain. And in a llama and in a person, those primitive parts of the brain are very, very similar. They're same in all mammals. Things like fear, seeking, separation anxiety, rage. It's the same in many different animals. The neurotransmitters are the same. You know, you get serotonin, you get norepinephrine, you know, though that's similar. Now, these are the core emotional systems. And you have fear. Fear is the motivation that makes an animal get away from predators. Now, the llama is a fairly high fear animal because it's a prey species animal. Wide angle vision, always looking around for something that's going to eat it. You can have rage, that's anger. Then you have panic or separation anxiety. Separation anxiety, like when you take the mama away from a calf, that is a different set of circuits than fear. Like in sheep, for example, you can do really nasty, bad things to sheep, and they don't tell you. They want to hide the fact that they hurt so they don't get eaten up. But you take the lamb and the ewe away from each other, and it's blah, 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 because that's separation anxiety. Then you have seeking. And then you also have emotional systems involving young nurturing behavior, sex, and play. And these things drive behavior. Now, another thing that's really helped me in my work with animals is I'm a total visual thinker. The HBO movie yesterday did a really nice job showing how my mind thinks in pictures. There's a scene in there where a whole bunch of shoes come up all at once. You see, and they're all specific. And the thing is, In my mind, there is no generalized concept of a shoe. My concept of a shoe is based on a whole lot of individual shoes I put in a shoe file. Now, this brings up a really important thing in animal training. You want to avoid place-specific learning. The only place you train your llama is at home. Well, first of all, you might have a freak out at the show because there's a whole lot of new things there. But you want to do training in a lot of different places. So then he learns, well, that training applies in a whole lot of different places. Another thing you want to be careful about is fear memories. Let's make sure that first experiences with new things, like a trailer or going over some of those obstacles, is a good first experience. Because that first experience, like going over that bridge with the stairs, is a really bad first experience, falling down or something like that, he's never going to go near that thing ever again. First experiences, if they're done wrong and they're bad, can make a huge fear memory and they don't get over it. See, the problem is, if I train the animal to stop being afraid, I train it to close the file on the fear memory, but I can't delete it. There's no delete. And if the animal has a really, really high strung nervous system, it's going to be very, very hard to keep that fear memory closed. Now, one of the problems you can have is they often get afraid of something they were looking at or something they were hearing the instant that the bad thing happened. Like I know one animal that got afraid of the sound of nylon ski jackets kind of going shush, shush, shush. A horse that was scared to death of black cowboy hats. White hats were fine, black hats were bad. Because he was looking right at a black hat. And I think there's also a good chance he could get very, very scared of a great big black purse that was maybe about the same size as a black cowboy hat. You see, it's sensory-based thinking. You want to understand your animal. You got to get away from language. It's sensory based. It's a whole bunch of sounds, a whole bunch of smells, a whole bunch of things they see, things they feel. You know, different kinds of tack you might put on. It's going to be a different feeling picture. You might be fine with one kind of tack, but then something else that feels different, that's associated with something bad, then you get a great big, a big fear memory problem. It's what's called bottom-up thinking rather than top-down. You know, he learns everything by specific examples. So, okay, you're going to put the halter on right in a whole lot of different places. And I went to the demonstration this morning on how to reduce the flight zone in the halter. I thought that was really super good. So a lot of people, I take the halter and you go, and then they do like a predator. Like a predator halter. That's one urge you've got to prevent. Then in the discussion this morning, they were talking about, we'll work on reducing the flight zone when he's still at back off. When you give a reward, it has to be done within 1 second of what you want it to do. Otherwise, they don't make the right association. You know, timing has really, really got to be right. Otherwise, he's not going to get it. Another thing is detail. You know, an animal that's a prey species animal notices a whole lot of little details. When I started my work with cattle, and they showed this really nicely in the movie, I got down in the chutes to see the things the cattle were seeing. And they were seeing a reflection, they were seeing a chain hanging down, a coat on a fence. They were noticing all this little tiny detail that most other people didn't notice. And I find I have to give people checklists, all of these details. And I still have to keep talking about it. I've been doing these talks for 35 years. Why do I have to keep talking about things like a chain hanging down in a shoe? Because people don't remove them. It's like they don't see them. Something that's important to the animal is not important to them. And these things are especially important in new places. You know, okay, you might have some chain that's at home, they'll walk right by it, they've learned it's fine. But they go to a new place, it's something new, it's gonna attract their attention. Give them a chance to look at it. And I totally agree this morning with the same, we don't just force its head down to look at something on the floor. No, you give it an opportunity to look. You don't just force it down. But I thought those demonstrations this morning were really good about the loose lead, not pulling on the lead. The other thing you got to do is you kind of got to be matter of fact. I remember one time going out to a farm and they said he couldn't touch this foal, a 2-day-old foal. So I'm stroking the mare. I'm stroking her. And then I just reach over and my hands are all over the baby. It's done completely casually. Also, stroke. Don't be doing this. Stroke it. And don't do little teeny tickle touches. Because that sets off kind of a learning response. Yeah, you just reach over and you put your hand on it. And you can do that, and he doesn't even realize that you're doing it. Another thing is, end the training on a good note. You start to see, like, one out there, and I just took this little llama, and I got him to go over a couple of obstacles, and he's making this little noise. And I'm like, you know, I don't think I better mess around with a big bridge. You know, I don't want to take a young animal and have some disaster on this big bridge. Let's just stop it while it's on a good note. You know, that, and I'd be perfectly honest, there's some things in llama instinctual behavior. I don't know it as well as I know it in cattle and horses, but I didn't like that little sound he was making. I said, let's just stop it before you have a problem. You know, so you're ending it on a good note. Now, how do we know that there is a fear center in the brain? And the thing that's really stupid is a lot of this research was done a long time ago. Why is it taking so long to get this research out where everyone would see it? I think some people don't want to think an animal has emotions. They think it's being anthropomorphic. So when you look at the brain and how the brain is made, what's the difference between, you know, a llama and a dog and a person? Basically, it's the complexity of the cortex. We have a gigantic computer up here to filter all the emotions through. So we can take the basic emotional systems and make it so much more complex. Animal just simply doesn't have the computer power that we've got. Now, if you stimulate the fear center in the animal's brain, you get fear reactions. Research done a long time ago, it's definitely there. You know, some people have said to me, well, you're being really anthropomorphic, and I said, this is neuroscience. These are refereed scientific papers. That's the only references I'm going to use for this. So how do you know the amygdala is the fear center? Well, if you just go in and remove the amygdala, then the animal explores everything. It explores everything because it's not afraid of anything. If you take a monkey and you put him in a strange room, you know, he'd want to get up here and be hanging off the chandeliers because he has an instinctual behavior to go up high when there's something, you know, in a new place where it might be dangerous. Take out the fear center, down on the floor exploring everything. And you have rats that no longer fear cats. Those aren't going to live very long in the wild. Rats don't fear cats. You know, that's sort of something they're instinctually afraid of. Now, when you handle an animal, and you do something really rough, and in the demonstration this morning, they talked about three guys and a bunch of beer to holler a llama. Well, if that's what you do, that's very bad, and I guarantee you your stress hormone levels are going to be off the chart. You do some rough thing, you force it, you get very, very high levels of cortisol. And then you've got deer there where someone shot a net over them, tied them down for about 30 seconds, and they go, well, that can't be very stressful. It only took 30 seconds. Yeah, what if you got mugged? Someone knocked you down, they grabbed your wallet and knocked you over and everything. Maybe that'd take 15 seconds. But you're going to be really, really super stressed over that. You see, that's fear stress. In fact, you do it bad enough, you can get post-traumatic stress syndrome. And then humans, there's genetic differences on who's going to come down with post-traumatic stress syndrome. And I think it's possible to get something similar in animals. You have an animal of very high-strung genetics, been horribly abused. It doesn't get over it easily. Now, beef cattle, plant cattle, and the dairy cows. Why is the stress hormone so low in dairy cows? Dairy cows voluntarily cooperate. This is another basic principle. When you're not forcing the animal, then you don't get fear. You know, if you're forcing it, you hold it down, and you force it. Yes, three guys drunk on beer definitely could hold down a llama. But you're going to have an awfully stressed llama, and he might even get afraid of the smell of alcohol in the breath. I actually knew that in a horse where that happened. Usually, the things they get afraid of is auditory or visual. You know, something happened. Like, I knew an elephant was scared to death of diesel-powered equipment. Boy, if it ran with a diesel engine, it was bad. If it ran with a gasoline engine, then it was safe and it was just fine. Now you've got cattle down here sleeping. Very low. Here we got antelope almost at the sleeping level. These are antelope that we trained at the Denver Zoo to totally cooperate with their veterinary procedures. Here they are training them, and we had to go through a very long habituation phase. I mean, this animal is the hair trigger flight animal. I mean, a llama is like super tame and docile compared to these guys. These guys have explosive fear reactions. And you had to go through this whole period. It took 10 days just to train it to tolerate a sliding door going up and down. The first day, we moved the door 1 inch. It goes like that and orients. That's all we did that day. Because we had pushed it past that orienting phase. it's going to go into an absolute fear thing and panic. Now, one of the things we learned with these trained animals is that the bad person who had been involved with a dart gun, doing all these bad things, that person could never handle the trained animals. You could bring in strange people, they could handle the trained animal, but the bad dart gun man, he couldn't handle it. They knew his voice, they knew what he looked like. Another thing that animals will do, especially when something bad happens, is they'll pick out some big distinguishing characteristic, like guys with beards, girls with long hair, you know, some big giant molasses, certain kinds of clothing, you know, like white shirts are bad. I mean, they'll pick out some big kind of distinguishing characteristic, something they were looking at right when the bad things happened. Now, I know you've got a llama rescue group here, and if you can find out what the things the animal's afraid of, you might be able to just remove it from its life. Now, that's not always possible. White shirts, I'd have a hard time getting rid of all the white shirts in the world. But one of the things that happens with horses is they'll have a bad experience with one particular type of bit, like maybe a jointed kind of bit, a snaffle bit. So any jointed bit, you put in their mouth, they freak out. But if it's a one-piece bit, then they're fine. Now, if you hold those two bits, you've got a different feeling picture. Another thing we've got to do, I don't know how many times people say to me, my animal is fine at home, and we went to the show, and it went absolutely berserk. Well, there's a lot of new things at the show. Flags, balloons, and bikes. Those are scary things. Bikes are scary because they sneak up fast on you and they don't make a sound. They don't tell you they're coming. Flags and balloons, a lot of erratic movement. Let's get them used to those things. Maybe decorate the pasture with them and let him just come up and explore those things and learn that those are safe. They need to also get used to different people. Some of the animals that can just have an absolute explosive fear attack when they go to a fairgrounds or someplace like that is an animal where all its life has just been handled by maybe one or two familiar people. It hasn't gotten used to strange people touching it. It hasn't gotten used to different vehicles. One of the problems we have with cattle is you can have cattle that have been handled on horseback and they're nice and tame with a small flight zone. Then when you get a person on the ground, they're going berserk. But think about it. Person on the ground is a different picture than a person on a horse. A person inside a pen is a different picture than a person outside a pen. So maybe they've got a no flight zone at all. If you just reach through the fence, you go in the pen, and they go crazy because nobody had gone in the pen. It's actually good for animals to learn to tolerate some variation in routine. And again, first experience is good. You want to load in a trailer, let's not have a wreck happen loading in a trailer. Another thing I can't emphasize enough is non-slip flooring. I went out there on that grooming stand. That's a really nice grooming stand, but I'd like to get some better non-slip flooring in it, because when it's put there on the grass, even I found it kind of slippery standing on that. Animals start to jig when the foot goes like this. It's just going to get more and more freaked out. You got to get a little non-slip flooring. And doing veterinary work, animals panic, and it's not the separation anxiety kind of panic. I actually don't like that word the neuroscientists use, the word panic. I think it's just terrible. I'd rather call it separation anxiety, because panic gets mixed up with fear. But I cannot emphasize enough the importance of non-slip flooring in places where you've got to, you know, work on their feet, groom them. That's a nice chute, but I want to get some kind of mat in there or something in there to give that animal much, much better footing. Another thing is, and I tell this to my students, never, never, never leave an animal alone in a restraint device like that grooming chute. Any animal. Doesn't matter what it is. I know students that have done that and their animal panicked when it was by itself, and that may have been separation anxiety, and it ended up getting injured. So no matter what species of animal you have, you don't leave them alone in restraint devices. And a lot of these herding animals, this is separation anxiety. It's probably a combination of fear and separation anxiety by itself. Totally by itself. And sometimes they can tolerate that when they have the person they trust. Well, I don't know how many animals have been hurt or died, even died in a restrainer because somebody had to go to the bathroom. I know of two cases. One was a goat and the other one a trained goat. There was and the other one was a show steer. And the show steer cut his foot and the goat strangled and killed itself because it was left alone for restroom break. You just don't do it. Now, Thing is, when you handle an animal, do something with it, that's a fairly short-term stress. But you also can have, you know, long-term stresses. And we got to make sure we give animals good environments. Now, things like the animals such as the llama, I mean, they're out grazing and they're out there with other animals. They got a really good environment. But I'm concerned about people that keep animals locked up. I just read a really awful thing about a sheep. You know, the fine wool sheep they have in Australia, they've kind of eaten on really poor feed and stuff like that, kind of hungry all the time, makes the wool fine. I read that somebody's taking individual sheep and locking them up and about half starving them to get fine wool. That's absolutely awful. That is absolute total animal abuse. And this gets into, you know, animal welfare questions. Now, first of all, basic animal welfare things, we got to maintain body condition, not have lameness, not have internal and external parasites all over them. There's some basic things that we've got to be doing. We also have to give the animal a decent life psychologically. And locked up alone all the time, that's not a decent life. And then you might get abnormal behaviors, even to the point where they're injuring themselves, weaving, pulling out wool and things like that. We've got to make sure, don't ever let that kind of behavior get started. If they get started doing some of this abnormal behavior, it's very hard to stop it. I can think back, you know, when I used to do rhythmic, stereotypic behavior, and I did it because loud sounds hurt my ears, and it was like taking a drug. I just tune out the world. And we also, I'm sure most of you won't be screaming at animals. Screaming at animals is something that needs to stop. That's really, really stressful. Another thing is, let's say your animal has some big disaster at a show, and it's all totally excited and scared. It's going to take 20 minutes to half an hour for it to calm back down. You know, give it time to calm back down. If there is some gigantic mess that happens to the vet or something, give it a chance to calm back down. That's going to take up to half an hour. They get scared instantly, and there was work done in cattle. Heart rate monitor put on feeder calves in an auction, and then it took a long time for that heart rate to go back to normal. You got instantly scared, but it goes back to normal slowly. You know, then we got to start looking at things like how behavior is motivated. For example, in the hen, there's a lot of animal welfare issues right now, trying to figure out, well, does a hen actually need to have a private place to lay an egg? Well, in the wild, hens wanted to get cover, and hide so that, you know, predators are not going to eat them. So there's fear motivated to put her egg in and be in a secluded place when she lays her egg. And I thought it was very good in the talk this morning. You don't just take the pack and just slam it down the back of the llama, because what do you think the puma does? Goes slamming down on the back. Well, you don't want to be acting like a predator, or you bring the hauler up like this and go, I really, really liked that demonstration this morning. I hope somebody videotaped that. That was a just excellent demonstration. And there's some behaviors we need to, you know, provide the right things. Now, the thing is, we need to figure out when you have a problem, what's motivating your hand. And if it's a problem when you're handling it, it's usually going to be due to fear. But okay, how about berserk llamas, the syndrome, you know, male llama attacking people. We have that same problem in horses, but really bad dairy foods. You got the hand-reared male calf, orphan calf, reared by hand, gets sexually mature at 18 months, 2 years of age, and they start attacking people. I can assure you right now, that's not fear. That is a different emotional system. That's going to be aggression. That's not fear. And one of the reasons why he does that is it's mistaken identity. It's mistaken identity. He thinks he's a person. So when he gets sexually mature, he's going to prove he's the big man. And in a dairy bull, that can end up in a dead person really quickly. It's not a tameness issue. It's a mistaken identity issue. You know, and one of the ways when I tell people with the bulls is if you're raising an orphan bull calf, just castrate it. Let's get rid of the problem. I know that llamas get really big and weird things happen if you geld too early. But the best thing to do is maybe get it on a, you can still bottle feed it, but get it out there living with other animals. So it learns it's a llama, it's not a person. And that will avoid a lot of problems with the aggression when it grows up. And this tends to be more of a guy thing. You know, there's kids raising steers in their backyard all the time, and there's no problem with, you know, steer attacking. He just doesn't have that motivation. Now, there's some interesting things learned about motivation. Okay, you get a gerbil, you have it in your kid's bedroom, you know, and you got it in a fish tank that you converted to something for a gerbil to live in, you put some dirt in there. He spends all day digging in the corner. So you think, well, maybe I'll go ahead and give him more dirt. Well, you know what? He doesn't really want the dirt. You know why he's digging? He wants cover. This is an animal that naturally wants to get under cover. Maybe a piece of cardboard over the top of the cage would work. I had a chance to go out with some people that were working with quail and banding quail and collecting blood samples and things like that. And they just had them in this open wire, like chicken cage thing. It was open to the sky, and they're really stressed out. And we just covered up half the cage with something opaque. It's got to be opaque. And then they could hide underneath the cover. You know, that's, you know, they have that instinct to do that. Okay, what exactly is instinct? And the scientific word for instinct is a fixed action pattern. Okay, the chicken has an instinct to go hide somewhere and lay her egg. The gerbil wants to go under something. Okay, when bulls fight, they go like this. The horses go like this. Okay, the motivation there's aggression, but it's expressed differently. Bulls are hardwired to do this, and horses are hardwired to kind of go more like this. It's the same thing, it's fighting, but they have a different sort of like computer program on how to do fighting. Now, one of the places where human instinct kind of collides with animals is dogs. You know, go on the internet and look up pictures of children hugging dogs. And the dog's kind of got the mouth clamped shut. He's tolerating it but not really liking it. Because in dog language, when you put your hand over the shoulder, that's dominance. For primates, it's lovey-dovey, but for dogs, it's dominance. You see, the emotional circuit in the dog's wired to another little different fixed action pattern than the human one is. They tolerate it, but they don't really like it. Because if the dog's relaxed, the mouth will be just sort of a little half open, the tongue a little tiny bit extended, not panting. And just go through those pictures. How many of those dogs, when the kid's hugging it, the mouth is clamped shut? It's not growling, it's not lifting its lip, it's tolerating it. But it's not really liking it. Because you see, our instinct, you know, primates hug, and dogs, it means something different. Okay, and then the gerbil's digging, and then he gave us the pre-made burrows, and was happy and had a place to hide. And this is an anti-predator behavior, natural anti-predator behavior, to find a place to hide. You have little animals, huh? Aerial predators get them. Hawks come down and get them. At least the llama doesn't have to worry about aerial predators. No, this is an animal that may get a lot of grazing animals like an open space. Because nothing, they can see the bad things coming. The predators don't come from the sky. You see, because sometimes you're trying to understand the behaviors. You look back at what was the sort of the evolutionary history of your animal. You know, when it was in its natural environment, what predators did it have? Aerial predators, you know, land predators. I don't think there's any, well, maybe baby llamas, there might be some eagles could get them, but the adults are not going to get, you know, taken away by eagles. Now, okay, let's talk about aggression. This is an ancient old experiment where they stimulated a cat's thalamus and went into rage. And I studied this when I was in college, in general psychology class. Now, the problem is that they called it fake rage or sham rage. In my general psychology book, they called it sham rage. They didn't want to believe this was real rage. See, they didn't want to believe that animals actually have emotions. No, it's not. Sham rage is real rage. And that's what I was taught back in the 60s. But there was actually some experiments done in the 1965, right? Well, even before I went to college, that's when I graduated from high school in 1965, to show that this wasn't fake rage. And they found that when they stimulated the thalamus, that the cat would attack a stuffed rat that was realistic, an anesthetized rat. At least they would have enough ethics on these live ones. But it wouldn't attack a rectangular white styrofoam block. It did know the difference between a rat-like thing. It aimed the behavior at something that was appropriate for it to attack. You know, like you put this remote control in there, it wouldn't have gone after that. It's not appropriate for it to attack things. You don't go after things. It wasn't a fake range. And when you look at the dates on these experiments, I mean, these have been around for a long, long, long time. And about 10 years ago, I did a paper for the Journal of Animal Science where I introduced some of this literature. You know, and it was like totally new. You go over in the veterinary literature, they don't like to use the fear word. They'll call it agitation or excited. Well, if you have a llama go berserk at a show, that's fear. Fear is a proper scientific word. Now, how do you know that this most interesting research has shown the fear system and the separation anxiety system, or panic, as the neuroscience called it. Really don't like the term panic, but that's what they call it. I'd rather call it separation anxiety, that these are different systems in the brain, is that Fiery and his colleagues over in France were able to breed high fear, low separation, high separation, low fear. Just with breeding, old-fashioned breeding, they could breed separate lines. You see, these emotional systems, things like seeking, some animals are really high seekers, other animals aren't. Some animals are really high fear, some are really high separation anxiety. They could breed all the different genetic lines. And the way in birds, there's a behavior called tonic immobility. You know, yeah, it hypnotized the chicken, and it stayed really still, so it's relaxed. No, it's not relaxed. It's absolutely fearful out of its head. And it's got really high stress hormones, and the longer it stays frozen, the more fearful it is. It's tonic immobility. Again, go back to the wild. You know, let's think about how I'm going to keep from getting eaten up by hawks. Sometimes there's a point where I need to freeze. Okay, let's say I'm out in the open. I just got to freeze. Hopefully, he won't see me. Because a hawk's very sensitive to rapid movement. The thing about rapid movement, it makes a prey species animal lots of times want to run and get scared. But it makes dogs and cats the predator. It makes them chase. You know, it makes them chase after stuff. So that's tonic immobility test. The test for the separation anxiety, which they call social reinstatement in France. You know, another problem we got in science is scientists have all kinds of different names for stuff. And what they did is they had a little moving sidewalk here going in the wrong direction. And if this little quail by himself wanted to be by his buds, he had to keep fighting the treadmill or the moving walkway going in the wrong direction. And that was used for the test for separation anxiety, two different traits. You know, what do we have to do to avoid separation anxiety in dogs? Well, they need a lot of companionship. Other people, other dogs don't handle being home alone very well. People ask me all the time, well, I work, you know, 10 hours a day, 6 days a week, so they get a dog. I suggest maybe a cat in this situation. Because cats are somewhat nocturnal, sleeps during the day, you're home at night, and if you do have to be awake, they handle being home alone a lot better. They're more independent. And now seeking is the behavior exploring new things. And again, this is an old experiment that showed if you take out the amygdala, yeah, it goes and explores absolutely everything. The thing that's crazy when you go back and you look at this old research is that there's still people say, well, they don't have emotional systems. Well, they're going to express it in a more simplified way. You know how a dog can be wagging his tail 1 minute, growling the next? The emotions are less complicated. Okay, I put a clipboard out in the middle of a pen of cattle. I don't come up to it. That's seeking. The wind blows a piece of paper, they run away. Then the paper stops blowing, they come back. I don't remember watching this. I mean, it was like 15 years ago when I first did this sort of thing. And I'm going, it looks like there's a switch between approach and fear. They're either in fear mode or they're in seek mode. We used to call it curiously afraid. And well, pigs are highly motivated. They like to root a lot of stuff. But the mechanism in the brain that determines seek or fear has actually been located. It's in a thing called the nucleus accumbens of the brain, and it can either go into seek mode or into fear mode. Works like a teeter-totter. And depending upon the animal's genetics and the animal's environment, it can kind of be biased more towards fear or biased more towards seek. Animals have been horribly abused. That will tend to make more receptors for fear on a teeter-totter. And of course, that interacts with genetics. You know, if it's already weighted towards the fear side, animal's been in an abusive environment, it's really going to be towards fear. But if he's in a good environment, then you're going to get a few more receptor sites to go towards seeking. It actually oscillates back and forth. I had a really weird experience. or me in an emergency situation, my nervous system went from seek to fear. I was driving along on the freeway, I was coming back to the airport, that's sort of the story of my life, minding my own business in the right-hand lane, and this idiot passes me in the left lane, and he has this little low trailer, no tailgate, and a 2x6 board about that long, slides off this trailer. And it's coming across the freeway like this. I locked onto the, like a fighter jet radar, and my vision slowed down, that board was floating. It was like 1 inch above the pavement. And I locked on, and I moved, I slowed down, and I moved the car over. I went over onto the rumble strip, over onto the breakdown lane, straddled the board. Managed to totally avoid hitting this board and having a really bad accident. And then, as soon as I had successfully avoided the accident, nucleus cone was switched, and my heart started pounding, and every swear word you can imagine came out. I'm not going to repeat that. I was just using all kinds of bad language to describe the car and the trailer and everything else. But I was in sync avoiding the thing, and then it was like a switch. It was instantaneous as soon as I had managed not to get myself killed. Now, an example of seeking behavior, the pig's an animal, when you think about it, what do pigs do out in the wild? They root everything. This is an animal that manipulates everything with its mouth. So if he's living on concrete, he doesn't have anything to manipulate with his mouth. Really, really high seekers, and they're going to want to, you know, chew on straw, chew on things that are soft objects. You know, pigs that live in some of the commercial farms that are chewing the bars, they got nothing to chew on. Well, let's give them something to chew on. And I did an experiment when I was getting a PhD where I gave pigs new things every day. New stuff is interesting. New stuff's a lot more interesting than old stuff. New straw was more interesting than old straw. After they got all ripped up into pieces this long, that old straw was boring. This is the paradox of novelty. It's both scary and attractive. Causes fear when they shove it in their face, but it's attractive when they can voluntarily approach. Because the thing is, if I just had all these negative emotions, the animal wouldn't go out and forage. I've got to have something to make it go out and look for food, make it go out and look, you know, it's got to go out and do things. Can't just have all, you know, negative emotions. It's, you know, it's got to go out and seek new forages and new things to eat. And but interestingly, on forage, there's been some interesting research with sheep and with cattle. At least in sheep and cattle, animals tend to like to eat the feed that mama taught them to eat. In other words, what they ate when they were growing up, that's the feeds they like to eat. So let's say you know you're going to ship this animal off way across to the other end of the country, and he's going to have to eat some other new feeds. It might be a good idea before he's shipped to get a little bit of that new feed and feed it to him, you know, and let him eat it there with his mom. And, you know, it's basically sort of like, you know, they like, you know, mom's home cooking. And they tend to prefer things that they ate when they're young, and they don't have to eat a great amount of it to do that. We already talked about the nucleus accumbens, how that can flip back and forth when seek fear mode. And also the environment can affect it. This was an experiment with this singer here, he looks like possibly scary, and they blasted the rat cages out with that. And that tended to bias the nucleus accumbens to much more towards the fear mode. Okay, now there's some other interesting things where you have seeking, but then you have liking. Okay, you know, This is brand new research that's funded by the National Institutes of Health on gambling, trying to figure out the mechanisms in the brain on pathological gambling. You know, you go to the casino, you blow the paycheck, yeah, that was seeking, but you sure didn't like it very well. And what the research has found, that there's separate circuits in the brain for seeking, but also did you like the thing that you went and got? And rats, they lick their lips. It's something that they like. And then of course you can get things like distress vocalizations. And you also, in the nucleus accumbens, they were mapping the nucleus accumbens. This is where there actually was a mapping for the teeter-totter. Like at one end of the nucleus accumbens is fear mode. All receptors in there for fear. The other end, it's all seek mode. And then you get mixtures of receptors in between that kind of determine which way it's gonna go. Liking and wanting, two different things. There's a baby that's not liking something it tasted, and licking it, something you like. And wanting, licking is, I'm sorry, I have to look at that, I can't read this, you're on the computer, it's too far away. And, there's two different neurotransmitter systems that operate this. Liking is the opioid system, and wanting is dopamine. Dopamine junkies, these are the ones that are gonna climb Mount Everest, they're gonna jump off of buildings, do all kinds of really crazy stuff, they wouldn't be caught dead doing, jump motorcycles off big high ramps. I saw this thing on 60 Minutes where they had people put on Batman suits, they were jumping off the top of a mountain. I wouldn't be caught dead doing that. Poor cameraman was freaking out. He was really scary. I don't think he was having a good time at all. He was tied on with a rope. Oh, and then what they did, the mapping, they got much more precise mechanisms. They went through the nucleus accumbens, putting little micro injections to different parts of it, and they could actually map out the whole nucleus accumbens and actually find out how this switch works. And this switch actually does exist in the brain. We have one too. And the thing is, it's down in the subcortex. And so emotions are actually something very primitive. But we can make it much more complicated. Because we have 10 times the computer power on top. That's what separates people from an animal, is the amount of computer power. And we've got huge frontal cortex that greatly makes things a lot more complicated. You might want that chocolate sundae, but after you ate it, you feel kind of sick. You don't really like it very much. And that's the way you're going to feel after you just blew the paycheck away, gambling away with the paycheck. Okay, you have to think about, I always want you to think about, the one llama is your main animal, but you may work with other animals too. What's the environment that animal had back originally? Because these sort of ancient emotional systems, they don't change all that easily. And polar bears pace a lot in the zoo. And the reason why they pace is because in the wild, it's a nomad. It's a big seeker. It walks for miles and miles and miles and miles. And why do the grazing animals get a lot of mouth stereotypies? Cribbing, ripping wool out, chewing on all kinds of inappropriate things, because that's an animal that out in the wild, all it does is graze all day. It's eating low energy food, and it's got to eat a lot of it. So this guy paces. And what do we do to give him a better environment in the zoo? We got to give him things to do. And I went to the zoo in Detroit, and they had this great exhibit. All this water, and the keepers would throw fish in the water in all different places, and the bears would have to dive for those fish. But these bears were so out of shape that for the first 2 months, they hardly could barely get to the bottom of the pool to get the fish, but then they gradually got in shape. And guess what? All the pacing and stuff stopped. But we've got to work on preventing abnormal behavior from getting started. Because once it gets started, it's oftentimes really hard to get rid of it. Dogs need a lot of seeking activities, a lot of things to prevent separation anxiety. But again, there's a lot of variation. Let's look at Labrador Retriever. You got those skinny labs that are ball crazy. They just want to chase the ball. And then you got those heavier kind of labs that make really good service dogs, maybe for someone in a wheelchair. And they're just very content just to lay there by the wheelchair all day, as long as they're, next to their, their person. Horses, we got to be very careful from all the grazing animals to habituate them very carefully to new things and not frighten them with new things. And they need things for their mouth. They also need companions. I know too many animals that are locked up by themselves. I would never recommend anybody to get one llama. They're social animals. They want to be with other animals. And these research is old. The Society for Physiological Society is putting a lot of this stuff up online. It's really interesting. And they're letting you get in on a limited amount without having to pay. And if you get too many things, then you'll have to pay. But you can get a few of these old articles. Those are some of my books. And what I want to do right now is just open up the rest of the time for all kinds of really good discussion, because that's sometimes some of the most interesting stuff. And if nobody has any questions, I'm going to pick something. Right back there. Well, I think they've got a mic on that. They should be able to hear in this room.
I'm allowed out.
Okay. Whoa. That's not.
Okay, there we go.
Why not?
About 2 months ago, I rescued a German Shepherd puppy. He was 7 months old at the time that I rescued him. He's does very well with women, and he's okay with certain.
Hates men. Guys. That's a common thing with dogs. Yeah, ladies are okay, guys are bad.
Yeah.
And that's a common thing, unfortunately. You know what? Let's just not use the mic.
I can hear fine.
Let's just not use it. I can hear fine. That's just too much feedback, and I have some problems with that. There's some generalizations that animals will make. Like guys are bad, beards are bad, long hair is bad, white shirts are bad. They'll pick out some. Sunglasses are bad. You know, some big feature, and he's afraid of some guys, but not others. Well, he's picking out some kind of a feature that some guys have that others don't.
How can I get him over that?
Well, you're going to have to just do some regular, you know, operant conditioning kind of stuff where you reward him for not being afraid. You can gradually get him over it. One of the problems is that these fear memories can come back like flashbacks, just like it does in a veteran. They get flashbacks. And the thing about the veterans is, let's say he had 20 veterans that were in some really awful thing, and they were all in the same awful thing. Only two or three get PTSD, the post-traumatic stress syndrome, where they get the flashbacks. The others don't. And you're going to have to just work on some operant conditioning things where you give them treats for not acting scared in front of the guy. If you can find some specific thing they're afraid of, I get rid of it. That's something I like to do. But the problem is, it's never going to be as good as the new dog you have messed up. Yeah, you can do things to rehabilitate it. One of our faculty members got a rescue that was afraid of just about every new person. And I went to a party at his house just recently. And you could actually get your hands on the, and I was a stranger, but I got my hands on this dog where before you couldn't. You just have to gradually work with them. Another thing is reward confident behavior. You know, if it's cowering in the corner, it doesn't get the treat. It gets the treat when it gets up and it wags its tail and it's acting more confident. We want to reward the behavior you want. And you have, and it's going to take a lot of work. What is the animal? What's the problem? Is it a dog?
It's a dog. It's a German Shepherd.
And he's afraid of certain kinds of guys?
Tall.
Tall? Okay, well, a tall man probably did something to him.
Right. So whenever anybody tall goes near him, he literally, the tail's underneath.
Yeah, totally scared because the tail's tucked under and he's totally scared.
Yeah.
And if you want to read dog postures, some of the best books on that is Patricia McConnell. She's got a fantastic book on animal emotions. It's got great pictures of all the different dog postures. You know, you're going to have tall guys just work with them gradually and try to get them desensitized to that.
Okay.
And try to not be, you know, maybe like, you know, shown this morning with a holder, you don't go up like this and then, you know, try to keep movements matter of fact. Don't make a sudden movement. But on the other hand, don't sneak up on it like a predator. And now in your household, do you have a tall guy that he's afraid of? All right, well, you start having that person feed the dog.
Okay.
And start having that person just associated with all kinds of good things.
Okay. Thank you. In the movie last night, you had a scene where you first climbed into the pen with all the cattle.
Yeah.
If I'm approaching a herd of llamas or anything.
Well, if you lay down in the pen of llamas, they'll come up to you. And
state of mind, were you in a seeking state of mind?
Oh, yes, lay down in the pen. In fact, that scene in there, that scene where Claire's laying down the pen, that's actually a real scene. There's nothing fake there. All she did was lay down the pen. Now, the one mistake she made, she did get her hand stuffed on. When I do it, I put my hands like this. She shouldn't have had her arms outstretched. The other thing is, you never do that in a really small pen. Because if something's scared of it, you want to have enough room for it. Also, never try a stunt like that with cattle fools, because I'm worried about it. Striking, but basically they'll come up to anybody. I've had cameramen laying on plywood out in the middle of a feed yard, and all the steers have just come up and sniff all around them, just being there. They'll come up.
Do they carry that over then when you stand up?
They're more scary standing up. And you're sitting here, they'll come up to you more than if you're standing. But then also on reducing the flights, like was shown this morning, Okay, you impinge on a flight zone, it moves away, okay, then you back off. Then you come back to the same distance, if it stays still, then you back off, just rewarded, not, you know, running away.
Can they feel your fear? I mean, that's what I...
Oh, yeah, I think animals can feel your fear. They can pick up your fear. And there are fear substances. Like I've seen in cattle and pigs, you have a situation where they get stuck in a chute, a real mess, and they're like jammed in there for like 15 minutes, pee and slobber all around on it. Then there is a fear substance that comes out, and you're not going to get another animal near it. Let's say a llama got tangled up in that grooming chute. I'm going to want to take that grooming chute and wash, scrub it all down before I try to use it again. But it isn't just a single little weird one. It seems to take like 10 minutes or more for the fear stuff to come out. And it's in the saliva and it's in the urine. And I want to not have that come out. But when you can go into, and the cattle that they used in the movie were flight zone reduced cattle. And they used the same method to reduce the flight zone of those cattle that was shown this morning. They were not hauler broke. They were regular cattle that were bought at a regular auction. And they picked out like a lot of photogenic white heads. That was one of the things I recommended. Because the white heads, you get nicer, deep, you know, nicer face shots. Because you see the detail of their faces. But they just do that. She just laid down in the pen. And then they had a guy up on a big, gigantic, scary, high cherry picker taking the pictures. And then all of the cattle handling scene where they went through the blue dip vat, that was real. They spot them in and they walked through. That's the first time they went in there. Because if you look at those pictures where they entered the single file, there's no smudges on the paint. It that actually worked. You know, all the cattle stuff's absolutely real. The slaughter scenes, the first one's all faked up with editing. It's all editing. And then when the fake cow drowns and that's a fake cow, that's done with editing. It's just an edit jump. But the other cattle scenes are absolutely real. There's nothing fake in that. It was a real squeeze shoot on a real ranch where that was done. And it's
so if you have someone visiting your farm and they seem to be afraid, or they say they're afraid, or I want to go...
Well, if they get too afraid, they're not going to come to you. But if you just sit on a bucket, they tend to come up. You tend to be less of a threat when you're not standing.
You wouldn't mix people. You would say, oh, don't be afraid. Just come on in here and grab the person in there.
Well, I don't want to drag somebody in that's afraid of it. But because animals know, they're very, very sensitive to body posture. See, the thing you got to do is get very matter of fact. Okay, when I took that llama, I'd never even seen that llama before. I just walked up there and I just expected him to go over the little log thing, horse jump thing, and he went over it. But then after about the third one, I heard that little mewing sound coming out, and I go, stop there. We're not doing anything else. I don't want to have anything go wrong. As a young animal, I could really screw it up. But one of the whole tricks is very matter of fact, you know. And then the thing that all they talked about, not pulling on the lead all the time and everything. I mean, those were great demonstrations this morning. They were very well done. I hope somebody. I don't think anybody videotaped.
You mentioned briefly about PTSD possibly.
Yeah, the thing on the genetics is some animals and some people
right.
have a better, they don't get as scared. See, there's differences in how strongly the amygdala makes the fear response. You see, before I took antidepressant medications, I had a lot of fear response, and the reason I had to eat yogurt and jello was I was from due to my right amygdala. It's now been scanned, it's actually huge. And that's the part of the amygdala that responds to outside threats. It's been damped down with medication that I've been on for 30 years. And then I'll get such a big fear response. But you see, genetics will determine startle. Okay, like if I put a firecracker off, I'm not recommending this. Some sudden stimulus like that, like an umbrella opening suddenly, and I had a heart rate monitor on the animal, and I had a blood testing thing that, you know, I got a catheter where I continuously monitor it. The heart rate's gonna go up faster and harder. The stress hormones are gonna go up faster and bigger with the same stimulus. It's called a startle response. And an animal that's high fear has a bigger startle response. Now you have the same genetics in people. And people that get scared more easily are probably more likely to get PTSD than people that don't. You see, there's an interaction here between genetics and environment.
Do you have any reference, or could you point in the direction of some literature?
On what, on PTSD or on?
On what you're talking about in humans, and it's like veterans coming back.
Well, you go on that PubMed database and just start searching. You'll see the abstracts. Then some articles are free, and then you're going to see something where they want $35 per paper. Then what you want to do is track down the professors that did that research and email and ask for reprint. But if you're on Google Scholar, you might have trouble getting back into the professor's website. So you need to back out of the browser. Then you bring up Disney.com. That's my test page. I use Disney.com to test the network. And you know your internet connection's trashed when Disney.com goes to a disgusting default site with no really ugly-looking old website with no moving, no video on it. Then you know that something drastically wrong. So that's my test site. So I go back, I bring Disney.com up, that clears the whole thing. Then I can go into regular Google and go search on the professor's website. Sometimes to find that, I got to back out. I got to go to Disney.com or CNN.com or, I don't know, Fox.com or ABC.com, send any old other website, kind of clear out the internet, and then you can go search for that professor's website. Sometimes it doesn't work once you're in the... There seems to be some weird stuff with the internet. I just find that sometimes I got to get out of academic mode and go back to regular mode. To make sure I'm back to regular mode, I clear it with sites like Disney.com. And then I go www.google.com. Okay.
I'm sorry, I'm going to have to cut off questions because we do have to get out of this room. Thank you very, very much.